Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Baldwin. With me is my co-host, bouncing in this brand new 2019 at a svelte 8 pounds for, well, maybe not. It's my man, the I almost said the Christmas baby. It's the New Year's baby, Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing?
I'm the New Year's baby. I'm doing great, man. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How were your holidays?
My holidays were exciting and eventful, Jeff. How about you and the family?
Had a lovely time up in the Atlanta area. Also was stopped by Jacksonville to visit my parents. Had a great time. Ate too much food. I'm not going to go have my blood work done because my doctor's going to look at my blood work and go, what the hell did you do over the holidays, my friend? And on this show, we're not going to just break kayfabe on blood tests. We're going to break kayfabe on pop culture, music, television, wrestling. Ah, hell, we're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's show, our New Year's Day edition. Happy New Year to everybody. Welcome in 2019. Good Lord, Barry. Think about that. We're going to just gonna break kayfabe on all that stuff. We're going to break kayfabe on the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. We're going to break kayfabe on our movie of the week. As recommended by Mr. Barry Rose, we're going to talk to recent Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame inductee, Bill Apter. We are also going to be discussing the restaurants that Barry and I went to over the holidays out of town. Got a perspective from a different city, and some we highly recommend, some there's a little bit of wishy-wash on them, and we'll talk about that. Barry, you ready to go, my friend?
Let's do this.
All right, let's do this. First of all, before we go anywhere, Barry, I don't know if he's working me or not, but we had someone that just joined the message group. I want to give a shout out to Chris Kumain. You want to know why I want to do that, Barry? Chris Kumain, according to his Facebook page, is from Tasmania. I don't even know if there's such a fucking place. But when I saw that, I went, holy shit, we've got someone listening to our show from Tasmania. And it's not, the Taz from ECW. So that's pretty cool. So a shout out to Chris, Barry.
I want to see photos, too. If we actually have a listener in Tasmania, I want to see photos of Tasmania. That would be pretty exciting to me.
I want him to go into the wilds and get a picture of a by God Tasmanian devil for me. That's what I want him to do.
Yes,
all right,
sir.
Barry. Before we get started and everything, I think we should start off by talking about our movie of the week. Barry, you were the one that recommended it. We had some great follow-up by our listeners. Our chosen ones this week are three. Why don't you talk to us about your movie recommendation of the week?
Yeah, so this was pretty cool. There must be a bubble that I live under that I only come out of every once in a while, because up until about 2 weeks ago, I had no idea that this movie even existed. And I'm scrolling through Netflix, and it's a movie called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, directed and produced and all the good stuff that movie folks do by the Coen brothers. And if you've listened to this show for any length of time, you'll know that I have based a lot of my life around The Big Lebowski. It is my second favorite movie of all time. But I love their entire catalog of films, going back to Blood Simple and Raising Arizona. There's just a lot of good stuff that's there. Oh, brother, where art thou? There's a lot of good stuff that's there. So I saw this, and I said, Jeff, what do you think? Jeff said, let's do this. And we did. So we sent it out. And we reached out to three of our group members, Joe Martinez, Anthony Rankin, and the infamous Joshua Greenbaum.
Go ahead, ask me about Joshua Greenbaum.
Still hasn't bought a fucking t-shirt yet, but we did it. And Jeff, you're going in order, right? Whoever commented on that thread on Facebook.
Exactly.
So if your name is on there, and literally there's, I think Jeff said, there's almost a year at this point that is there, we will get to you. The people that jumped on soon are already reviewing movies. if you're one of the last commenters, look, it may be a year, but whatever. We will get to you at some point. So in any case, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and it's coming from the Coen brothers. So this is interesting. This was a movie that got a limited theatrical release, and by that I mean I think it appeared in like 10 theaters for like a week, and then it was on Netflix, so it was pretty quick. And it's an interesting movie. It's actually six vignettes that take place in the Old West. It mixes humor, it mixes comedy, it's very dark at times. It's partly a musical. It's all over the board, I think is a great way to describe it. So as I mentioned, we did reach out. We have three of our Facebook group members. Jeff and I have watched the movie. We've reviewed it. So where do we start, Jeff? Who do you want to start off with?
I tell you what, I will take what we reached out to one of the guys you said was Anthony Rankin.
And yes, sir.
I'm going to take Anthony first, if that's okay with you. Anthony said, the Ballad of Buster Scruggs, a worthy addition to the Coen Brothers filmography. The six vignettes are classic Coen Brothers, mixing dark humor with offbeat storytelling. Gee, that's almost what you said, Barry. Although the stories aren't connected, the characters have similarity with other Coen characters, such as James Franco's hapless bank robber, similar to the character in Raising Arizona. The singing cowboy from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou are obvious examples. The outstanding cast really ties the film together. The use of veteran character actors makes for layered storytelling. After initial viewing, you could sense there's more to the stories than just under the surface. All in all, a very enjoyable film with a little bit of everything. Highly recommended by Anthony Rankin, Barry.
Yeah, and so he makes some really, really good points with that as well, too. I think if I look at this, I think the tone of the movie is very interesting. They did a really nice job with the sets. The acting's fantastic, so I definitely agree with Anthony on that one. So I will take, and I'll save Greenbaum for you, actually, Jeff. I'm going to take
thank you.
Joe. I think you could probably have some fun with that one. I'm going to take Joe Martinez. So Joe, extremely polite. Thank you for letting me be on the first episode of Breaking Kayfabe's Movie Club. Joe, between us, it's actually the second episode, but I won't tell anyone.
What he doesn't know won't hurt him, Barry.
He'll be fine. He doesn't know. I really enjoyed The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. All five stories were very different. I felt the strongest of the stories was the gal who got rattled. I was not expecting the ending at all. I thought the acting of the actors who played Alice, Mr. Knapp, and Mr. Arthur were very good. My second favorite story was All Gold Canyon, just one man trying to find gold with twists and turns. My favorite character of the five stories was Buster Scruggs. He was a badass, riding the horse and singing country music, exclamation point. The saddest for me has to be both the gal who rattled because of the ending and meal ticket. My least favorite was probably the last story, The Mortal Remains. It was still good, but not as good as the others. I just want to say thank you again for having me on and looking forward to more reviews in the future. Very interesting. So he was a big fan of the All Gold Canyon, or that was his second favorite. His first one was The Gal Who Got Rattled. So the young lady who plays Alice, I had only seen her in one other movie. Her name is Zoe Kazan, which somehow with that last name makes me think that she's part of Hollywood royalty. She would have to be. But she was in a movie that I watched maybe 2 weeks ago, and it's on cable right now, and I have no idea what the fucking title of the movie is. But it's about a girl who, I guess, is dating a guy. She goes overseas to Europe. She comes back. They're broken up. But she winds up getting an apartment, I think, right below him. He lives above her. And she's in that movie, too. She's very interesting. She's got an interesting face, if that's the right way to phrase that. She's not your typical Hollywood, you know, drop-dead gorgeous type of actress. Really great actress, though, and I actually like her a lot. So, Joe, I want to thank you for the review. I definitely like your choices right there. But, Jeff, you're saving Joshua Greenbaum for last. This can be good right here.
And I will say, before I start discussing Joshua's thoughts, feelings, and views on the movie, because he's nothing if not insightful, spoiler alert, because he threw out some spoiler alerts. So if you haven't seen the movie yet and you don't want to have the events of the movie, the scenes of the movie spoiled, by all means, at this point, for about 2 minutes, shut out all thoughts of Joshua Greenbaum and turn the sound down. Sometimes more of us would like to do that, but I digress, Barry. So Joshua says, I watched the movie. I definitely liked it. I didn't love it, though. I wasn't sure what it was supposed to be. I thought it was a comedy, but then it turned out to be an odd drama action film. Poor Buster dies in the opening minutes, and I thought, well, maybe they'll show him how he got to that point. The rest are clips, though. They're completely unrelated. All the segments are really good. There's some fantastic performances. Tim Blake Nelson as Buster was great. Liam Neeson was really great. And I was bummed when he tossed the quadriplegic over the bridge. Spoiler alert there, Joshua.
Yeah.
I could see it coming, but that sucked. The guy that played the quadriplegic was great too. Everyone in the final act was fantastic. The only person I could recognize was Tyne Daly, but she was great. James Franco and Stephen Root would have stolen the movie if not for Liam Neeson. The whole movie could, you know, by the way, I can tell Joshua that you voice texted this thing because there's a lot of little typos in here that comes upon when I try to voice text something. Going through the Coen Brothers catalog after shocked me. I didn't know they had anything to do with Spies Like Us. I loved that movie as a kid. However, their greatest achievement is No Country for Old Men, which is a great movie. I'll agree with that. Sorry, yeah. Barry. I know The Big Lebowski is great, but No Country is fucking amazing. It's one of the best book adaptations of all time. Thanks for letting me do this, guys. And I'm sorry I wasn't funny, witty, or poignant. Well, you tried. Good movie, though, and some really great performances. Keep up the great work. Thank you for your participation, Joshua. We do appreciate it. And now, Barry, is it your turn or mine? First of all, what do you think of Joshua's thoughts?
I'm going to bust on him a little bit, but I got to be honest, he's actually like on the money with that, with a lot of the stuff that he says. I don't agree that No Country for Old Men is better than Big Lebowski, but it is it's a 4-star movie. It is fucking amazing, to quote Josh right there as well too. But he does make some really, really good points. I think the one point that sticks out for me, James Franco and Stephen Root would have stolen the movie if not for Liam Neeson. I mean, James Franco, you and I have talked about it too, is I don't think we were ever fans until The Deuce came up, and now we're both fans. So I thought, but there's another actor from The Deuce that's in this as well, which is the guy that plays Harvey Wasserman. David Krumholtz is also in this movie. So we got two actors from The Deuce. Stephen Root is in every movie ever filmed for the last 25 years. He's fantastic. Most people know Stephen Root from Office Space. That's my stapler. I need my stapler. He played that guy, but he's been in a million movies. He's great. The acting was great in this. Tim Blake Nelson was great. I loved the first story, which is the Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I had no idea where this movie was going. And watching what happens in that first vignette, pardon me, I really liked it. This is where I think in a lot of ways, I think that everybody had the same thought. And I know that privately you and I did as well, Jeff, but this is a line that makes a lot of sense to me. The whole movie could have been great, I think, if it actually told a cohesive story. And that's where I think, to me, that this movie is uneven. It's disjointed. Again, the acting, as good as you're going to get. Some of these stories, they're fantastic. The movie is a little long, and I do think that some of the vignettes, they're uneven. Some are way too long, and I think the Ballad of Buster Scruggs was way too short. So I would have liked that they chopped, I don't know. It just seems like it's all over the board. Again, I like it, though. I don't want that to come off as I don't like it. Do I feel it could have been better? Yeah, I feel like it could have been a lot better, though.
Okay, well, I'm going to throw out a little knowledge to you right now. The aforementioned Zoe Kazan.
Yes.
Stars on The Deuce. Oh, yes. She played Andrea Martino on the first two seasons of The Deuce. So you got that going for you there, Barry.
Who was Andrea Martino?
It shows that she is an actress on The Deuce. So she apparently had a role in it.
Okay.
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Seemingly everyone in that show was. So let me give my thoughts and views. I'll give pros and cons. First of all, on behalf of Mrs. Bowdern and my daughter, they both completely hated this movie. And I mean, like, they started watching it when we were up in Atlanta. We watched it, and 45 minutes in, they both kind of gave me the WTF is this. And so, you know, they were not big fans. They wanted me to pass that along to you. However, I will now offer my viewpoints and say that while my experience was not entirely positive, it was not entirely negative as theirs were. First of all, and one thing you haven't mentioned, this is an absolutely beautifully shot film. Every single one of the vignettes, the cinematography and the camera work is absolutely top notch. Just beautiful scenery in the background. Of all the vignettes, I think my favorite one was with, and here's again, someone you didn't mention, was Tom Waits, where he plays the gold prospect, which was just, you know, probably had 5 lines of dialogue in a 20-minute sequence, and it was just an interesting story about a prospector looking for that big gold strike that he thinks is going to bring him all this happiness and stuff like that. It's the scenery as he's just digging near this creek or this river is just spectacularly. See, I don't know where they shot it, but oh my God, it's absolutely Beautiful. I like the aforementioned, what was it called, Barry? The one with the girl that got rattled.
Rattled.
Okay. That was until like the last 30 seconds was probably my favorite, even more than the prospector. But the last 30 seconds just really kind of, I was like, oh, fuck. There are some dark endings to this. And that's one of the things that it just, to me, I think with maybe one, the exception of one vignette, every ending had a very dark ending to it. You know, it was just like, wow. And like, you know, it was just kind of like depressing. And you're sitting there thinking, this is such a beautifully shot film. The acting, you're right. James Franco, Liam Neeson, Tyne Daly, just some great character actors in this that all do a superior job. But yet you're sitting there going, oh my God, I'm just like, man, I got to go listen to some music or something. Cause man, I'm so, this movie is such a downbeat. And now let me talk about the last thing, the last vignette, which was about the people on the stagecoach. Barry, what was that called?
I'm going to call it the people on the stage.
We'll call it the people on the stagecoach. So the people on the stagecoach who are taking, let's be honest, their last stagecoach ride, and it becomes glaringly obvious at some point during that stagecoach ride where they're going, Barry, except they don't realize it, and there's a reason that the coachman won't talk to them. And to me, as you realize what was happening, I found that to be a real, next to the prospector story, to me, you didn't like it. I thought that was the most interesting story, because once you figure out where the storyline is going, it makes everything so interesting. And when they leave and they walk up the stairs and Tyne Daly to the end, like, you know, saying, I'm a lady, I demand to be escorted. And, you know, she's keeping her chin up to the very end. Tyne Daly is one of those character actresses. God bless her. She wasn't, you know, she was not blessed with beauty queen looks, but every single thing she's ever been in, she had, you know, geez, I remember,
she's,
I think first role was probably what, Magnum Force with Dirty Harry? Was it Magnum Force or was it another one of the Dirty Harry series? You know, The Enforcer, maybe?
Seemingly she's been around forever though.
Yeah,
so I have to agree with you on
just
that,
a really good character actor. Though always good in whatever she does, and she totally owns this role, and she's on the screen for maybe 15 minutes, and but she's really good in it. And you know, again, as she comes to the realization of why they're on the stagecoach, it's, you know, kind of a poignant scene, but she remains to the end with the nose and the head held up high. And so this is one where I don't know if I can fully recommend it, because the endings of so many of the stories are so downbeat, it's a little bit depressing. But that being said, the acting and the cinematography and the photography are so beautiful that I want to recommend it. Unlike you, I was not a big fan of the very first vignette, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. To me, and this is just my opinion, I thought that was one of the weaker points of the movie. So, but overall, kind of a mixed bag. There were some things I really liked, some things I didn't like, Barry.
Yeah, and that's the way. So I pulled up a bunch of reviews, too, and I should say, pardon me, this film won the Best Screenplay Award at the Venice Film Festival. I don't know if that's Venice, California, or Venice, Italy, so, but in any case, they won Best Screenplay. But I did pull up a couple of reviews, and this will just be lines. I'm not going to read the whole fucking review, but A.O. Scott, which really, I mean, that's about as pompous a fucking name as you could ever have, A.O. Scott, from the New York Times, says, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs swerves from goofy to ghastly so deftly and so often that you can't always tell which is which. Owen Gleiberman from Variety says, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is a pop fantasia that's interested in the meaning of what a brutal place the Old West really was. Sandy Schaefer from Screen Rant says, certain segments are far more engaging than others, but overall, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs makes for an intriguing piece of anthology storytelling. I know I'm not supposed to drink before we do the show, Jeff, and I got to
stop hitting the pipe.
Yeah, it's got to stop. And lastly, as I finish my adult beverage, David Edelstein from Vulture says, The Coen's newest Western, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, might be their bleakest work of all and one of their richest. So that's quite a really interesting review right there. And also, I do want to point out Anthony Rankin, in his review, used the word titular. And I don't believe we've ever used that word before. He said the titular singing cowboy. So quite frankly, that makes me happy that we had the word titular on our podcast this episode. But Jeff, I, you know, maybe in hindsight after reading this and hearing these other reviews, maybe I like it a little bit more than when I was actually watching it. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I want to point out a couple more character actors. Brendan Gleeson, Saul Rubinek, who was also in Unforgiven as the writer who was covering all the events that were going on. And I want to go back to something you said, just in wrapping this part up here. Zoe Kazan, who played the girl and the girl who got rattled. You know, you mentioned that she's not a beautiful girl. She had a kind of – and, you know, as I watched it, I thought to myself – she had a really interesting – this would not have been a good role for someone who's like, you know, Scarlett Johansson or something. You know, this needed a girl who had almost a plain look to her, because let's be honest, if they're trying to recreate what life was like on the prairie and, you know, on the Oregon Trail, which is where that story takes place, you know, these girls are not going to be wearing makeup. And I thought she conveyed an average look, and I mean, I'm saying that in a completely positive way, as ridiculous as that sounds, because she really looked like someone who you could have seen out in the Old West. She was playing a very conservative girl who had gotten basically stranded out there and was depending on, as they say, the kindness of others. And so, you know, I thought her face really made her part. It made part of the story was how average looking it made it more believable, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But
absolutely,
she did a
And let me quantify that statement. So she is, you know, in this era, which I guess Hollywood's always been, it really is about beauty, and she's not what we consider a typical beauty. That being said, I'm super fucking attracted to her. So whatever it is, in this movie, not as much, but this movie I saw where she lives in the apartment, there's something about her, and it's the way that she carries herself, and the fact that she isn't cookie cutter. There's a uniqueness about her, and Jeff, this just in from Kippelman's Corner, Zoe Kazan is indeed the granddaughter of Ilya Kazan. So yes, this is Hollywood royalty right here. But I think she's got that Amy Madigan quality, and I should say I don't think I ever found, and that's not a knock on her, I don't think I was ever attracted to Amy Madigan. Fantastic actress, maybe one of the best and underappreciated of all time. I do think Zoe Kazan has got a future, though, in playing offbeat characters, less glamorous characters, and I know that I'll certainly be looking for her in the future.
Yeah, no, she's a very interesting actress to watch, you know, as Lou said, she's the granddaughter of Lanny Kazan, and so she's got some
I should have let that one go right there. She's the granddaughter of Lanny Kazan. Gay maid, right there. Lanny Kazan. I think it's, and she may be, actually, quite frankly. Wait, okay, Lou is also laughing. Lou, can you find out, is she related to Lanny Kazan as well?
What did I say?
You said Lanny Kazan, but it's Ilya Kazan.
Oh.
Like, exactly. That's what makes it so good.
Maybe there's a relation.
Happy New Year, everyone. Happy New Year.
Thank you for the week there, Travis. So anyway, now, based on that, let's go to the Hall of Fame. Hey, okay.
Hey.
So now it's time for us to discuss. Wow, that's a pretty good one. Let's talk about the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame and those people that got in. And some of our thoughts, views, and comments. None of these people, by the way, as far as I know, are related to Lanny Kazan. But, so first off, we'll start. So let's start off with the highest vote total went to Mexican wrestler L.A. Park, who was, of course, started off, I believe, as La Parca before he got into some contractual and copyright disputes with the wrestling promotions down there. Barry, your thoughts on L.A. Park getting in?
Yeah, you know, so he had a hell of a career. Big in Mexico, actually had a decent run in the U.S. When he came to WCW at a period where they were essentially burying most of the Mexican wrestlers, they were letting him have the best matches on television of either promotion, and then they would wind up doing the job, and sometimes to each other, but they really didn't do a whole lot with those guys. L.A. Park, La Parca, was a star in the U.S. He got over. And also got over, obviously, in huge in Mexico. I don't have an issue with him being in the Hall of Fame at all.
Okay, next, Jerry Jarrett.
Yeah, you know, look, Jerry Jarrett's legacy is huge. If you're a new wrestling fan, you're probably aware of his importance and the his role in professional wrestling. So I would say, look, if Jerry Jarrett didn't deserve to get in this year, he certainly deserved it in the future. So I have no problem with him either.
Yeah, I for one, can't believe with the promotional legacy that he has that he hadn't got in before.
Yeah.
You know, a guy who always had interesting things going on in his promotion. Let's be honest. There's also some negatories about Jerry Jarrett that you and I discussed before we went on the air today. There were also stories that he wasn't the world's biggest payoff guy from a promoter's view as he sat there on his big house on the hill. But, you know, there's no denying the years and decades of success that he had in Memphis and in other parts of the country. I know he was brought in famously in Atlanta to book for a while there. So a guy with a tremendous, I have to think that Jerry Jarrett was put into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame as a promoter more than as a wrestler. He had a tag team with Tojo Yamamoto for years that was well thought of in the Memphis and Tennessee areas. But I think it's really more as a promoter, of course. So next, Jimmy Hart.
Yeah, again, there's another guy. Look, Jimmy Hart, until he went to the WWF, people that saw him in Memphis, and we certainly have seen the videotapes, Jimmy Hart was one of the greatest wrestling managers, I think, of all time. And he was the top heel in Memphis off and on for several years. It was a rotating people that were in his stable, whatever he called it, Jimmy Hart's army and whatever it was.
The first
heels
family,
would come
Gary.
And go. First family, thank you. Exactly. They would come and go, but Jimmy Hart was the constant right there. So, yeah, absolutely deserves to be in.
Jimmy Hart, I think, really, when Jerry Lawler was out with a broken leg, kept the promotion going. And
yeah.
He was such an attraction that he kept the promotion afloat. He gets credit for that. So many people want to sort of not be in the, you know, fan club of Jimmy Hart because of his work, you know, in the WWF. Later in WCW with the, you know, the constant shilling for Hulk Hogan, which, you know, honestly, I'm not a big fan of either. His WWF work, I was a fan of, not nearly as much as Memphis, but he was a manager of the Hart Foundation, did a great job with them. But that being said, his 5-year run in Memphis, if he didn't do anything else but that, that would be Hall of Fame worthy to me, because he was electric in that role and probably – I'm going to go out there and say that 5-year run in Memphis outside of Cornette during his glory years and Bobby Heenan, I don't really know that there was a more effective manager than Jimmy Hart during those 5 years, Barry.
Yeah, you know, so I'm always going to be partial to Sir Oliver Humperdinck.
And sure, and that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, and there's a lot of parallels right there with the career, because Humperdinck was another guy that had a rotating stable of guys, but he was the one constant that was here for years. So, you know, he was great. I would say those two are at the top of their game. And, again, Hump's another one of those guys that, because of his exposure, most people saw Humperdinck as Big Daddy Dink in WCW, NWA, or his absolutely horrific, the role that he had when he was in the WWF managing Bam Bam Bigelow, and it was very short-lived. But Sir Oliver Humperdinck at his best is one of the best, and Jimmy Hart, again in Memphis, one of the best ever, I think.
Yeah, there's no, and we'll draw a quick comparison here, because one of the other guys that got in was Gary Hart. Your thoughts on Gary Hart getting in?
Yeah, so this is always a polarizing subject right here, isn't it, Jeff? So, we certainly were. You know, there was the people that weren't happy with our comments, but I think we could say, look, Gary Hart, up until that plane crash, was again upper echelon elite of professional wrestling managers. The issue that Jeff and I had, and we're not alone. Look, there were some other people that chimed in and agreed with us. And I believe even the great Brian Last was even agreeing with us at one point, that once he was injured in the plane crash, he really was never able to take these bumps. But whose fault is it then? Is it the booker for putting him in the ring? You know, I don't know. But Gary Hart at one point, great interview, believable interview. And Gary Hart did a lot of good behind the scenes too. Really, really good booker in Texas. I would have no problem with Gary Hart being in a Hall of Fame at all.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have some negatives about Gary Hart, certainly, and I've mentioned him in the past, the way that he was kind of his Machiavellian ways. I believe that's the first time we've said that on this show, Barry. In WCW, the way that he kind of, I feel, held down the Great Muta. I think he took a lot of credit for things that maybe he was a part of, but that he wasn't completely responsible for. He took more credit than he maybe was due. But that being said, there were also a lot of things that he did that were Hall of Fame worthy. His run in Florida, you're absolutely right. His run in Texas with the Von Erichs, that was great stuff. There's no question about it. He had a good run in Georgia with, you know, the Great Kabuki. That, you know, certainly puts him in that pantheon of great managers of all time. So I really don't have, you're right, I don't have a problem with him being in there. Now let's discuss some people that are a little more polarizing in their selection, dare I say. So first of all, Yuji Nagata is a guy that in New Japan right now is really sort of playing out the string. And, you know, he's kind of getting towards, it's the end of the rope. He was a big deal 10 to 15 years ago. I think he had some forays in the MMA that were not entirely successful, but he was a pretty big deal, 10 to 15 years ago in New Japan. I think now the problem is that when people look at him and they see that he gets in the Hall of Fame, they're looking at Yuji Nagata now than necessarily Yuji Nagata of, 10 or 15 years ago, Barry.
Yeah, Yuji Nagata. So what was the logic for him being in?
I got him. Okay. Okay. Maybe he got the Japanese quote. I don't know.
That was the logic.
Okay.
So there's not, Yuji Nagata had a nice run there as well, but there's not 100 guys in Japan that are more worthy than Yuji Nagata. And this is a question for our friend Eric Chulominski, who actually is in Japan right now as we're recording this. But aren't there guys who are more deserving than Yuji Nagata?
Well, maybe we'll leave that up to Eric Chulominski to chime in, or our friend Ashley, our official New Japan representative, to offer her comments on the message board. So then we've got Howard Finkel. This has sparked quite the discussion on various boards. Barry, Howard Finkel, is he Hall of Fame worthy?
It's Howard Finkel. So if we're looking from a tenured standpoint, certainly Howard Finkel has been around literally before you and I were even born, Jeff. He literally seems to have been around. I know he's disappeared. He's got serious health issues. I hear he's not doing well, and I don't think we're ever going to see him again. I hope that information is incorrect. Is he in as a ring announcer and just a ring announcer? Then sure, maybe in the Hall of Fame of ring announcers. In a professional wrestling Hall of Fame, again, there's not, 40,000 people who are more qualified to be in. I would say that there should be. Hall of Fames, Jeff, I have issues with Hall of Fames. I'm part of Hall of Fames. I with CWF, I kind of run a Hall of Fame, though it's voted on as well. But, Hall of Fames, it's a weird deal to me. Awards are a weird deal also, I don't really always get them.
Yeah, so here's my thought. Howard Finkel, he was perfectly fine as a ring announcer, did a good job, okay? Did he, to me, transcend the industry in a way that somebody like Jimmy Lennon did, or dare I say Michael Buffer, who, like, when you think about ring announcers, you think about Michael Buffer, or somebody like that, or Jimmy Lennon over the history of pro wrestling. I know that there are guys out there that worked Florida. The guys in Green, Dr. Tom Miller in Greensboro was an unbelievable ring announcer. And I know John Hitchcock and Bruce Mitchell always talk about the greatness of Dr. Tom. And, there were ring announcers that I don't even know what the guy's name was. The guy in West Palm Beach that we used to see every Monday night was thin black guy that was great at his job. And yeah, I wish I knew what his name was, because he was terrific. And I know the guy in Miami Beach that you talked about before Frank Freeman. Yeah. So, how is it that, and I'll just throw two names out there. I'm not advocating for these two guys, but I'm just going to use them as an example. I know Brian Last has really been pushing for the last couple of years for Bull Curry to get in, okay? And I noticed that down on the list was Johnny Walker, Mr. Wrestling 2. So how is it that Howard Finkel gets in, but Bull Curry and Johnny Walker, Mr. Wrestling 2, don't get in? I don't know what quantifies Howard Finkel as being more deserving than those two guys who were on the ballot. It's just kind of an interesting question in my mind. So now, Barry, there's one last guy that got in. Now, I will say that I've heard a couple podcasts where his entry was not entirely 100% well received. Let's just say that. So at this point, Barry, how about you and I sit down and talk with Bill Apter about getting inducted into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame? Let's go to that interview now. Okay, well, we are extremely honored to be joined here on Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry by newly inducted Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame member Bill Apter. Barry, how cool is that? And this, by the way, Barry and Bill, the very first podcast that Bill is doing after his induction. Gentlemen, welcome.
Well, thank you. It is an honor to be here. And other than a mention on my podcast is the After Chat, this is the first interview I've done because I found out, and hi, Barry.
Hi, Bill.
And I found out, I spoke to Dave Meltzer today, on Friday, and I found out that he had been talking to several people who knew I was going to be inducted, but I didn't know about this. And the way I found out was Missy Hyatt, who has been advocating for me to get in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame like for 900,000 years, tweeted, finally, Bill Apter has gone in there because she believes that I was deserving of this because of the years I worked at the PWI company, and she thought I was responsible for the genre I didn't approve of, apartment wrestling.
This was something I was going to ask you way later, Bill, but you just brought it up. So what was the deal with apartment wrestling? Whose idea was that? And where did these girls come from? Give us whatever you can tell.
Oh, yeah.
About.
Well, first of all, there's a whole chapter in my book, Is Wrestling Fixed? I didn't know it was broken. That explains everything about apartment wrestling. But since you have me here, I'm going to tell you this story. So there was a photographer out in Los Angeles back in the late 60s and the early 70s into the 80s, and his name was Theo Errett.
I have his book.
Okay. So it's a great book. Do you have my book yet?
Sorry.
Oh, my goodness.
My fault. I'm going to send Jeff because I have a copy and I read it again today. So in preparation, Jeff, for Christmas, I'm sending you the copy of Bill Apter's book.
You want to know where my research comes from, Bill? It comes from the three boxes of Inside Wrestling and the Wrestler that I have in my bedroom. As we are doing this broadcast, quite a bit of my money went to Apter Industries.
Well, you see, and we're going to have to discuss that, too, because everybody thinks it was me. I was the face of the magazines. But let's get back to
the apartment wrestling.
Yeah. So Theo was our photographer for both wrestling and boxing, because we also did four boxing magazines at the Olympic Auditorium and the L.A. Coliseum. And he also photographed models. And one day, Mr. Weston, my publisher and my mentor, and the guy who started me in this business of publishing wrestling magazines, he was the publisher, called me in. And Mr. Weston talked like this. And he said, I want you to see, I got some pictures from Theo today. And he opens up the envelope, the manila envelope, and there were like proof sheets and 8x10 pictures of these gorgeous gals in bikinis in wrestling poses. And he said, we're going to publish this and we're going to call it Apartment Wrestling. And I said, Mr. Weston, I don't think wrestling fans are going to buy this. Well, we're going to check it out. And if it sells, we're keeping it. So he published it in Sports Review Wrestling. And the magazines, to my chagrin, sold like double the amount that Sports Review Wrestling had sold before that.
Did they outsell Inside Wrestling and The Wrestler?
I don't know. I can't tell you that. But I knew it doubled the sales on
Sports Review.
Yes. Yeah. So this became one of the worst parts of my career. Because once the wrestlers started seeing what this was, since I was the guy who went out into the field and into the dressing room, and I always brought magazines with me, it was like, hey, Bill, what are you guys putting soft porn in them? I said, no, and I tell them the story. And then we had wrestlers like Chief J. Strongbow who would come over to me and say, I take these magazines home. I don't, if you're going to keep doing this, we don't, you know, I don't want to be in your magazine, the one with this thing. And a lot of wrestlers felt like that. And I go back to Mr. Weston and tell him this. He says, that's too bad. If they don't want to be in, we'll put them in anyway. We're reporting the news. We're a magazine. We're out to make money. We're a publishing company. And I'm like, at that point, Ralph Cramden, and you younger people, millennials listening to this, Google that. I'm there in the office going like, I don't know what to do. What are we going to do? Because now Vince McMahon Sr. and a lot of the other promoters are like, you know, get this crap out of the wrestling magazines. Even the fans were razzing me about it. Luckily, eventually, after years, it eventually ran its course. I never photographed. Well, okay, one time. But I never really was behind this. I did photograph one set with some models on Long Island in the apartment of Randy Gordon, who wrote boxing for us and wrestling.
Yeah, he was a very well-known boxing columnist, yes.
Absolutely, boxing columnist and also the New York State Athletic Commissioner eventually, and one of my favorite people in the whole world. There's a chapter about him in my book too, actually. So it eventually ran its course, and I think the pressure that I kept up on Mr. Weston eventually helped bring that to an end. And I was really glad to see it go. But I have to tell you something. Those magazines really were big sellers on the newsstands. And if you really look at it from Mr. Weston's point of view, he was a publisher, and he was in publishing to make money. But he was also a diehard wrestling magazine publisher. He was the guy who started Boxing Illustrated and Wrestling News, sure. and the original Wrestling Review. So to have him as my mentor was just amazing, that I was being trained by the guy whose magazine I bought in 1959 at Sunnyside Garden in New York City.
Wow. So Barry, I understand that you have a very interesting story about how you first met Bill.
Well, wait, before we get to that, what was that other thing I said we'd get right back to? We were just talking about.
Got to wait till Sweet Lou is going to prompt us. Barry, why don't you tell the story while Sweet Lou prompts us?
Sweet Lou will. Sweet Lou will come through. He's a producer extraordinaire. Bill, I just have one more question about the apartment wrestling. Then I definitely want to tell that story about how I actually met you. But now, Theo was actually using some hardcore porn actresses, though, for these photos, correct?
Oh, yeah. One of them, who we called Sonara, was a major hardcore porn girl. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, of course.
No, of course. No, definitely not. I mean, they're hardcore, brother. No, and they definitely did, but he paid them very well to do this.
And they
He had to keep telling them, keep your clothes on, please. We don't take the bikinis off. No, there was one special issue of Battling Girls, which may have had some nudity in it, but again, I don't remember. And those stories, by the way, the person that wrote most of those stories was the late, great Dan Shockett. His alter ego was a guy named Dave Mall, who was the Vince McMahon of apartment wrestling, or the Don King of apartment wrestling. And Dan wrote most of the apartment wrestling stories, yeah?
Wow. So if you're just joining us right now, this is the legendary and one of the newest members of the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, Bill Apter from Queens, New York, now residing in the suburbs of Philadelphia, my neighbor. So, Jeff, this was, I guess, about 6 years ago, a little over 6 years ago, and it was the day of Hurricane Sandy was approaching our area. And Hurricane Sandy just tore up the Jersey Shore. I mean, just did a lot of damage out there. And my kids were off of school, obviously, in preparation for this whole thing. So I loaded up the car with my son. It was probably 7:30, 8 o'clock, maybe 8:30 in the morning. And we made a trip over to 7-Eleven. We're going to get some water, whatever else it was. Right. And I go into this 7-Eleven, and I got to say, we live in a very nice area in the suburbs of PA, but we're off the beaten path in a sense. This is not an area that, you know, there's not a lot of famous people in this area is probably the best way to put it. However, I walk into 7-Eleven. I'm with my son, and my son, it's 6-7 years ago, so he's probably 10 or 11 years old. And I said, "You're not going to believe it, but you see that guy right there? I think that's Bill Apter." And he goes, "Who was Bill Apter?" And I said, "Bill Apter was the guy who was arguably one of the most famous wrestling journalists in the history of professional wrestling. And there's a phrase called Apter magazines because all the professional wrestling magazines that were coming out in the 70s and 80s were really, he had a huge hand in those." And he goes, "Really?" And Bill is standing there, and I think you were buying a newspaper and a cup of coffee or something like that.
No, I don't drink coffee. It had to be something fizzy.
I think it was a big gulp. And I walk over and I'm like, "Excuse me."
No, wait. Since I'm a reporter, I have to be accurate. I never had big gulps. I probably had Fanta orange soda.
Which is fizzy.
Right.
Which is fizzy.
Right. But out of the bottle. It was not in a cup.
Okay. And okay. I walk over and I'm like, "Wait a minute. You're Bill Apter. Are you?" I "Hate to bother you." And he said, "I'm Bill Apter. That's correct." And immediately we struck up a conversation. And you then, which I thought was the coolest thing, which my son just absolutely loved, you said, "You know, I have a championship title in the trunk of my car." And you took myself and my son outside, and we're standing outside in the parking lot of a 7-Eleven on the day of an approaching hurricane, and you gave my son the belt. He put it on, and I took a photo of the two of you, which I still have to this day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which belt was it, Barry?
I think it was the office championship
belt. Yes, it was the cow belt. Cow. Cow stood for, and still does, I still have it, is Championship Office Wrestling. And Wonderful Willie is still the champion, if you will.
Undefeated?
No, defeated two times with an asterisk.
Okay. So let me ask you. So when I, of course, discovered the Apter mags, if we can use that.
Stop you there for
a
moment?
Sure, go ahead.
That term used to drive me crazy because it came from Dave Meltzer.
Oh.
And Dave used to call them the Apter mags. And I used to call him and say, "Dave, I'm out in the field. I write my columns. I take the photos, et cetera. The promoters put me on TV, but I'm just a part of a great series, a great team of people that put out the magazines, and they're not the Apter mags. I've never been the publisher. Stanley Weston is the publisher. And I was never the main editor." But, well, he said, "Well, everyone sees you as the face of the magazines, so I'm not going to take it out of the Observer. It is the Apter mags." And that's how that came about.
Okay. Well, the Weston magazines that I discovered when I was a young kid, I remember the cover to this day. It was Freddie Blassie versus the Sheik. Freddie was covered with blood. You had Bruno doing a kind of a side turn wearing the belt. It was an Inside Wrestling magazine. I went out on eBay and I bought that issue because it was the very first wrestling magazine I'd ever purchased. So my question to you regarding the West End magazines during the 70s, I don't think it's a big secret, there was a lot of blood on the covers of the magazines. Obviously that had to be somewhat intentional by the publisher. Is that correct?
It was Mr. Weston. First of all, that photo of Blassie and the Sheik, I remember well, that was taken by Theo Arrett out at the Olympic Auditorium.
It was a flag match.
Yes. I don't remember what kind of a match it was, but that was a Theo picture. Mr. Weston's philosophy that blood and sex are what sells on magazine covers. And we kept up using bloody covers until the distributor, Cable Magazines, Cable, the magazine distributor, said that we could no longer do that. But I would always take guys into the dressing room. As soon as they bled in the ring, I was right behind them when they went back to the dressing room, and let me get a bloody shot for the cover.
Now, the stuff that they did in the Midwest, because Bobby Heenan was one of the all-time great bleeders on your magazine covers. Was that you taking those shots, or did you have someone working in that area, or what?
That's interesting you brought this up. When I first met Mr. Weston, we had made a date. I was living in New York, and he was on Long Island, and we met at the Men's Grill at the Biltmore Hotel, and he pulled out a magazine cover. It was the Wrestler magazine, cover date. Like January 70 or I think it was around then. And it was a full cover picture of Bobby Heenan completely cut open. Oh my God, Bobby,
What happened to your face? Yes, I remember that issue.
So that was the first cover I had seen. And this came from Mr. Weston, who put out the classiest wrestling magazine, Wrestling Review, that I had ever seen. That was my favorite magazine. And he had changed completely to a National Enquirer type of magazine at that point. And that cover, that's when he told me, he says, I make covers like this because blood and sex both sell. And did I like to see that cover and what the insides looked like? I was like, meh. But did I want to work for the guy that was the magazine guy in my past? Yeah. So I did, in answer to your question, though, I shot tons of bloody covers. And in the Midwest, sometimes I was at the shows, and sometimes we had either Brad McFarlane or a guy named Gary Kamensack or Gary Mancuso shooting our photos in the Midwest.
And just to follow up, when you changed based on the sort of the pushback from the network there or the agency, did you notice a drop off in sales, or did
when
it
you
stay
say
the same?
What network or cable?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Oh, that was our distributor.
The distributor. I'm sorry. Yes. So when you got the pushback from the distributor and you went to a less bloody cover, let's put it that way, did you notice any sort of change in the sale pattern?
I was not privy to the sales. I was the wrestling guy.
Okay. Yeah, so I didn't know whether or not you had heard.
No. Back then, I was still a rookie. Back then, I wasn't privy to the percentage of sales probably until the Hogan era. I wasn't interested. It didn't matter. I had a dream job. I didn't care. I got a paycheck every week. They owned everything I shot, all the photos I shot and everything I wrote. But I was living my dream, and I still am, thank goodness.
Sure.
Barry? Yeah, it's pretty incredible, too, because and I definitely want to talk about what Bill is doing currently. But, Bill, you mentioned Bruno Sammartino a couple of minutes back, and I know that he had such a huge impact on not only your career but your life as well, and he was an extremely close friend of yours. How hard was it losing Bruno, which we lost earlier this year?
I couldn't believe we lost Bruno. I thought Bruno was one of these people that were going to be there forever. He was one of the guys who endorsed me to other people in the business. And I think Barry and Jeff, you may know this. I have hours worth of audio interviews, and I run some of them on my on the After Chat podcast of Bruno from the night he lost the title to the night he got the title back, and a whole hour of his entire life story and all his feuds. Every time I was at the Garden, I always made sure I taped Bruno, and I still have all those audio tapes in perfect condition.
Wow.
But Bruno, I was to his house many times. I knew his family fairly well. I hosted many in-person shows that Bruno was a guest at. But anytime I needed to talk about anything inside the business, I could always call Bruno, and he would always be upfront. He was the most honest person I ever met in the wrestling industry, and he carried himself as a champion. He always dressed like a champion, and he always acted like a champion. So yeah, no, I miss him. I miss him very much. I still am very upset that I was not able to go to his funeral. There was a conflict that day that I could not get out of, and I couldn't be there. But I will always remember Bruno as a dear friend and someone who made a big difference in my career, my life, and putting me over.
Now, one of the things, too, and I
wait,
know because
Barry,
I've actually,
Barry, yes, wait, sir. Before we get off Bruno, do you know I do a Bruno imitation?
Lay it on us.
Okay, yes. You need to ask me if I hate a certain opponent, and this is the stock answer Bruno would always give. And just put, you know, ask me, Bruno, do you hate whoever it is? Go ahead.
Sure. Bruno, do you hate Stan Stasiak?
You know, a lot of people say this doggone guy, Stasiak, you know, hits people with the heart punch, doggone it. But let me tell you something. People want to know, you know, hate is a strong word. I don't hate Stan Stasiak, but I hold a lot of animosity toward him. That's what he used to
there
say.
There you go.
That's pretty good. Yeah, the doggone phrase was a big
Well, he was doggone you. You know something, this guy, and I want to tell you, that's my Bruno imitation. I always like to get that out there.
Okay, well, so it was great.
But hey, Jeff, I just had one follow-up that I wanted to – So, Bill, you were there the night that Bruno dropped the title to Ivan Koloff in the Garden. I've seen the photos of you in the building. Did you have any inkling that there was going to be a title change that night?
Again, it's in my book, but yes. And I'm going to tell you how I found out, because I was brand new in the business. Mr. Weston calls me into his office one day. His office was in his house in Rockville Center, Long Island. He tells me, and his office was in the upstairs of the house. And he calls me in. I was working in the basement. The filing cabinets were in the basement. And there was an intercom. And I hear the intercom click. And he goes, Bill, I need you to come up here. And I go up the three flights of stairs. And he says, come in here and close the door. He says, I'm going to talk to you about something right now. And you've never heard this and you never will hear this. You understand what I mean? This is something you cannot ever repeat. And I said, I thought like this is like his wife was dying or something. So he says, I just got a call from Willie Gilsenberg. Are you going to the Garden tonight? And he knew I was. I said, yeah. He says, have you got your camera and a lot of film? I had a $49 Minolta rangefinder camera with a lot of black and white film. He said to me, I want you to make sure that during the Bruno Ivan Koloff match, you have a lot of film and you keep changing film. There's 36 exposures. You keep shooting, all right? And I can't tell you why, but I think you know why. All right, and we never had this conversation. So now what do I do? Because I know about this, and my father, who was my best friend, always went to the matches, and they let him sit at ringside with me at the Garden. At the Garden, they had three rows of press, and they were separated by these large desks that went all the way around the ring, just like the boxing ring. And there was a ring apron at the Garden that to shoot pictures, you had to put half your body up on the ring apron, lay down and get under the bottom rope. And your gut would kill you after you shot 4 hours of wrestling there. I couldn't tell my dad anything. He had a $12 Kodak Instamatic camera that had these film rolls in them. So I just told him to have a lot of film, a lot of stuff ready for the Bruno Koloff match. And we shot the match. And then when I saw Koloff mount the ropes, I said to my dad, I think Bruno's going to lose. I didn't tell my dad anything. And we both clicked and shot at the same time. And I had the far superior camera and we had the film developed. My $49 Minolta took fairly good pictures. His pictures with this $10 Verstunkene Kodak Instamatic camera got published in the magazine before mine did.
And I've always heard that the crowd went dead silent.
It was like a funeral. It was like, you know, today people would start screaming and yelling. It was like nobody could. They said it was like a funeral, and the next day in the newspaper, in the New York Daily News, they had pictures of people crying in the stands. His fan club president, Georgianne Makropoulos, was sitting in the front row, and she was just inconsolable. It just stopped 22,000 fans from muttering anything.
Well, let me ask you, just as a follow-up to Barry's question, was Koloff, had he been pushed to the point? I mean, of course, every rival or every guy that they brought in to face Bruno had gotten pushed to a certain extent. But, you know, as a fan, you could sit there and say, yeah, yeah, I could see this guy. Maybe he beats Bruno. And then you have the guys where you're like, this guy is never going to be. Did Koloff give off the vibe that he was a real threat?
Captain Lou Albano did. And I have this on audio tape. Lou Albano would go, tonight, I know for a fact that Bruno Sammartino, and he'd go through. Albano generated the heat for Ivan Koloff. Mm-hmm. And they people wanted to know, people wanted to see any of Albano's guys get their comeuppance at the hands of Bruno. And they always went because they were sure that Bruno was going to kill off anybody that Lou Albano brought in there. And that night, as Bruno said in his interview with my on my tape recorder from my radio show that I did in New York called Inside Wrestling, that night Bruno said Ivan Koloff was a little bit better than he was. However, the loss was blamed not by Bruno, but by promoters that Bruno had been injured in Pittsburgh 3 weeks before and had ribs broken by George the Animal Steel.
Hmm.
So that's why the promoter said that Bruno lost.
Which is, of course, a great way to get Steel over as a rival also.
Oh, of course.
So here's a – I'm just thinking, obviously, Bruno had such a big impact on your career that you could see as you went through the years of the magazines. And obviously, I don't –
Well, he was – one of the things that Bruno did, by the way, and I know you're not asking me about this because you don't know this, is if there was a story in the wrestling magazines that Bruno didn't like about him – he would call me at 11 o'clock at night. My wife back then would say, it's Bruno. And I'm like, oh, my God, what's wrong now? Bruno always appreciated reporters that interviewed him about a certain subject. And back then, Mr. Weston had written a This Is Your Life, Bruno Sammartino. And he never talked to Bruno about it. And Bruno told me that so much of that story was not right, and his friends used to talk to him about it, and he was embarrassed that in that story, his sister, who was like 10 years old, took a rifle and killed a bunch of Nazis in Italy. You know, this type of thing. They were totally fiction, and Mr. Weston couldn't believe that Bruno didn't like stories like this. I'm the first guy that did a shoot interview with Bruno in the magazines that straightened out our relationship with Bruno for the magazines, but he was always very critical of any stories that he was quoted in unless he was actually quoted in it.
So, but of all the guys you saw, Bruno, you were obviously, based on the amount of photos that we saw, I'm assuming a big fan of Mil Máscaras. You've been able over the course of, 50 years to see guys like Steve Austin in his prime, Hogan in his prime, The Rock. Tell me who you think was the most over babyface for their time in wrestling history.
Well, first of all,
Mil Máscaras. That you saw.
No, hold on. First of all, when we're talking about Mil Máscaras, real name is Mel Moskowitz. He's a Jewish kid from the Bronx. Nobody ever knew that. But
who knew?
Who knew? Some of the ring announcer mispronounced it. It was a Spanish ring announcer, and he couldn't pronounce Mel Moskowitz. He called him Mil Máscaras, and it went over. That was it.
You've been saving that one, have you, Bill?
I have. The question that you're asking me, who was the most over wrestler I've ever seen in terms of crowd reaction?
Sure.
Had to be The Rock.
Really?
Of course. It had to be. But that, not saying that, I'm going to kind of back up on that. It was generational. Because in the Bruno days, it was Bruno. In the Dusty days, it was Dusty. In the Stone Cold days, it was Stone Cold. So it's – and the John Cena days, it was John Cena. So it all depends what territory and who was over in that territory during those days. But you're meshing everything together, which is fine. But I have to say that The Rock – and actually, I'm going to back up on that one too, and I'm going to say it was Hulk Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I'd never seen anyone get over like Hulk Hogan did.
Wow. Bill, what's your first memory of professional wrestling? You know, you've had such an amazing career. I guess it's literally almost 50 years at this point. What's your first memory of your lifelong, is obsession the correct word? Your lifelong obsession with professional wrestling?
It was when Abe Lincoln got into, no, it's not that long.
You're older than you look.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to tell you what it was. I was a kid in New York, and my brother used to, my older brother used to stand me up on the bed, and he'd go, no, move over to the left. No, 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 move over to the right. And then he'd go, drop kick, and he'd drop kick me off the bed. And I didn't know what he was doing. I had no clue. And then I saw him watching wrestling on TV. I didn't know what it was. And I started watching it a little bit with him. And then I remember in New York, beside the shows from the Capitol Arena, Vince McMahon Sr. shows, and the shows from Bridgeport, there was another show on Channel 9 called Bedlam from Boston. And there was a British wrestling host, and he was also a wrestler by the name of Lord Athol Layton. And he was talking about a wrestler named Dick the Bruiser. And as he was talking about Dick the Bruiser, Dick the Bruiser came out and kicked the crap out of Lord Athol Layton. And I was like, oh my God, this is like really cool. I've never seen anything like that. So that's the first thing that grabbed me. And then I saw Antonino Rocca, barefoot wrestler who did everything the luchadors are known for. I'd never seen anything like this guy. And then I saw Nature Boy Buddy Rogers, this guy with an incredible tan body glistening under the lights, strutting around and saying how great he was. So those are my first memories of my obsession with pro wrestling. Great question.
So if that's the case, and because you go back so far, I ask you about the best babyface reaction. Who's the greatest heel you ever saw live?
Wow, great question. Probably the original Sheik.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people's choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
So did you ever, while you're, we've heard stories, particularly I've heard stories about like Boston and places like that, but as you're shooting ringside, did you ever see any crowds that you thought, yeah, this is getting a little bit out of hand?
Oh, when I was in Puerto Rico, they had four corners there, and in each corner they would have a guard with a German Shepherd dog there. And when fans would rush the ring, the dogs would turn and I figured eventually when I die, it's going to be under a ring trying to get away from a crowd. I was at the Felt Forum, the small arena of Madison Square Garden, shooting boxing one night when there was a full-fledged riot where people started burning the seats there. Luckily, I got out of the building in time. I was at a near riot at Madison Square Garden. You had to be 13 years old or older to go to wrestling with or without a parent. But my father knew someone on the State Athletic Commission, and we got me in when I was about 10 or 11 years old. And Dr. Jerry Graham and Eddie Graham were wrestling Rocca and I think Miguel Perez, and the fans started to riot. And we were – luckily, we had seats on the top of the garden, and we weren't involved in that riot. But you could see the whole ringside was being torn apart.
Wow. That's pretty incredible that you were there for that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Bill, in reading your book, too, and again, a lot of this is coming off of memory, there's so much to be learned from this book, especially if you're into the history of professional wrestling. But you were really good friends with Andy Kaufman. And if I remember correctly, you were the one that facilitated putting Andy Kaufman in touch with the King, Jerry Lawler.
Yeah, that was all me. Now, you see, remember, I'm a New Yorker, so it's Andy Kaufman.
Andy Kaufman.
Thank you.
Kaufman.
Andy used to come to the Garden, and he wanted to wrestle. And Vince McMahon and the State Athletic Commission said no. And Andy was a fan of the magazines. He came over to me one night and he said, "What are you doing after the matches?" I said, "I go to my apartment in Queens where I live with a girl wrestler by the name of Susan Sexton from Australia." He said, "How do you get there?" I said, "Now remember, Andy was starring in Taxi at this point, one of the biggest sitcoms ever in history. He was a major star."
I'm not going to interrupt you, but who was living with Susan Sexton? You were?
She was my roommate for 3 years in New York.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Yeah.
It's in my book. Name.
It's in my book.
It's in the book, right?
It is. It is. And I've got many great stories about her to tell, but not tonight. So Andy said, how do you get back to your apartment? I said, I take the subway. He said, can I go with you? So here I am riding on the E-train back to the Van Wyck station on the E-train with Andy Kaufman. People looking at him on the subway. So we go up to my apartment, and we're talking wrestling. And after about 3 hours, Suzanne, I call her, said, is that all you two blokes can talk about, wrestling? She went in the bedroom, put on her headphones, started listening to the Ramones, Gabba Gabba Hey, and we never saw her again. So I said to Andy, I said, listen, I've got this friend in Memphis. His name is Jerry Lawler, and their promotion is way ahead of the curve. They do things like the Frankenstein Monster and the Wolfman, and he'd probably be somebody who might be interested. I said, let's call him. Well, he said, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I said, well, he's probably just getting in. So I called Jerry Lawler, and he says, you got Andy Kaufman, the guy from Taxi, in your roach-infested apartment? I said, yeah, hang on a minute. And I put them on the phone, and that put the key in the ignition, and Andy went down there a few days later, and that's what started the entire process.
And the rest, as they say, is history, huh?
The rest has become history, yes.
So, well, I tell you what, Bill, I want to just ask you real quick, as you've found out today or yesterday, that you received the honor of being inducted into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame again. Just want to real quick get some thoughts. Jerry Jarrett, Jimmy Hart, Howard Finkel, Gary Hart. There was another L.A. Park from Mexico, and Yuji Nagata from Japan. But tell us about your thoughts real quick. Right off the top of your head, just give us a quick...
That's what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. See, way back when, back in the kayfabe days, if you had any contact or talked to Dave Meltzer and a promoter found out, you were never allowed into that arena again.
Well, we're all about breaking kayfabe here.
Well, no, I know. That's why I'm on here. But that was... Dave and I laugh about it now, but I was one of the few people back in those days who communicated with Dave. We would talk once a week and share results and wrestling rankings and stuff like that. But Vince Sr. and none of these people knew that I was talking with him. So this is bittersweet. I'm in a lot of Hall of Fames, and people talk about three Hall of Fames: the WWE Hall of Fame, the Cauliflower Alley inductions, and the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. And this puts me in one of those three. People have asked me in the past, why aren't you in the Cauliflower Alley Hall of Fame? I don't know the answer to that. I can't tell you. Everybody I know who's a journalist is in there. I don't know why I'm not. To get into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, when I've been reading that newsletter, quality newsletter, for so much of my career, and people have been pushing for me and voting for me for so many years. And Missy Hyatt, bless her, every year she always gets out there and tells people to vote for me. This is a huge honor, because this is, I cannot tell you on Facebook and Twitter, email and Instagram, all the feedback of congratulations I have gotten from this honor. So I'm totally bowled over and knocked out, and I want to thank everybody for their fanship and their love for something that's been a dream career of mine that keeps on rolling, and all of your support.
Well, I can tell you, speaking personally, Bill, that a lot of the education of a young wrestling fan here in South Florida was made every single month when I would hit the bookstores, the drugstores, whatever, to pick up the Inside Wrestling, The Wrestler. And, it's funny. I had a incredible collection up until my high school days when, of course, as a lot of times happened with kids and their baseball cards, Mom decided that I needed to get rid of those magazines.
Yeah,
and I got rid of all the magazines, and then I ended up buying them again on eBay about 25 years
later. I know the
feeling.
Well, my dad and mom lived in West Palm Beach, and I was in Florida a lot. I covered Miami and West Palm very often, and I loved that Florida territory. It was one of my favorite territories. And my dad used to, on Monday nights, this was before cell phones, he'd cover the matches for me in West Palm, call me with the result, and he'd always say, hey, Dusty said hello, or this one said hello. And then the guys the following Monday, some of them would come to the garden, hey, we saw your father last week. So it was all, you know, it was the beginning parts of the wrestling fraternity becoming my family. It's wonderful. I loved Florida wrestling.
Yeah, no, I used to hit West Palm Beach very regularly, the auditorium. So, Barry, I think you got one last question for Bill before we let him go.
I do, too, and this is probably a great way to end this segment. I'm going to ask you your thoughts on Eric Bischoff.
Eric Bischoff and I used to get along great. We were in the AWA. I used to go down there and do the Pro Wrestling Illustrated press conferences. Vern Gagne let me do those even when they were taping for ESPN. And sometimes Greg would ask me, can Eric be the co-host of these? And I would have to say, he doesn't work for the magazine. And I'd call the publisher and he'd say, these are PWI segments, not AWA segments. So I don't think Eric felt slighted, but I felt bad about that. Through the years, I ran into Eric a lot. And during the WCW days, Eric always made sure that I was part of the inside gang there. I was part of the NWO. I was part of everything backstage. Things took a turn for the worse with Eric when he saw me in Los Angeles at the Inoki Peace Festival in the hotel very late at night. He'd come in probably about 11 o'clock at night, Pacific time. He was tired, and he got up to the front desk, and I went over to him, and he said, you know what? Things got bad because of my flights, and I don't even think they got my luggage, and now that I see you, things are even worse. And I said, what? Yeah. I said, what are you talking about? And there's a whole lot of people standing around. I remember Mike Lano, one of the photographers who worked for...
Oh, Lano.
The legendary Lano was standing Mike
there.
Lano.
Yeah, he was standing there, and a lot of other people were standing there. And Eric Bischoff said, you know what? Are you here to shoot the matches tomorrow? I said, yeah. He says, well, you can shoot all the matches you want, but not the matches with my guys on it. And he says, because you're a parasite. I said, what? This is me now, the guy that's respected in pro wrestling. He says, you're a parasite. You go where the wind blows. You're a parasite. And he says, and by the way, Randy Savage wants to kill you. And I'm like, what? So everybody's in the lobby. You go, what? That maybe he's tired. So I call my office. I call Stu Sachs, who was the editor at that point. And he said, you can't let him treat you like this. He says, you're Bill Apter. Everybody loves you. Everybody respects you. I said, I never had an issue with Eric. So I go up to my room to make that call. And then as I'm leaving my room to go downstairs on the elevator doors open and it's Eric. And he goes, oh my God. And the elevator door closes and I'm in the elevator with Eric Bischoff.
Slightly uncomfortable, huh?
He has his head down. I said, you know what? You can say whatever you want about me, but you can't call me a damn parasite. What reason did you... do you have to call me a parasite? The elevator door opens. He says, okay, you're not a parasite. But there's something wrong with what you do. I said, well, what? And now the Lanos and everybody else is starting to follow along and try and listen to the conversation.
That's hard to believe that Lano would do that.
Really? No, I love Mike. Mike's great. I won't let him do my teeth, but he's terrific. You know, he's a dentist, or he was
a dentist.
Yeah, of
course, yes. Okay. I've known him for years.
Yes. So he said, you write in the magazine. I said, well, sometimes, that Vince McMahon and Ted Turner are at war. You know what? I'm busting my chops to get this company over. It's not Ted Turner. It's Eric Bischoff. Ted Turner is funding us. And then I got it. And in my mind, I was going, he's upset, and he's right. Eric Bischoff really runs that company, not Ted Turner. Ted Turner is the money guy. And that's what he was upset about.
So in context, what you could say is much like Stanley Weston was the money guy and you were the face of his magazines, Eric Bischoff was the guy running WCW, but Ted Turner was basically the Stanley Weston of the story.
Yeah, but the war was between that everyone portrayed was between McMahon and Turner.
Sure, sure.
But it really was Bischoff and Turner. Bischoff and Vince, rather.
So as we wrap up, and Bill, first of all, I want to say how thankful we are for you being very, you know, very gracious and generous with your time, especially here as we're getting into the holiday season as we record this. So I'm going to ask you a question, and I just texted Barry, and I said, should I ask him this question?
Wait, is if wrestling's fixed, I did know it was broken.
Okay.
Okay.
So here's the question, and maybe you're going to say, maybe you'll kayfabe me and say, I don't want to answer that question. But I thought of it as you were telling the Eric Bischoff story. All the years you've been in the wrestling industry, or at least a parasite to the wrestling industry, Bill, who is the one
By the way, Eric did not remember that story when I talked about it.
So as you look back on all those years and you say to yourself, you know, that one guy, he was the biggest asshole I ever met. Maybe he didn't do anything to you personally, but you just saw his dealings with who's that one guy that was the biggest asshole you ever met?
There wasn't.
Really?
No, I got along with everybody. There were times when people and I got out of favor for short periods of time, but I can't pinpoint anybody as being the biggest tuchus of anybody. Asshole.
First time in the history of our podcast the word tuchus has been used.
What the fuck?
It was pronounced correctly too.
Correct. But no, there's nobody, you know, it's funny because I'm accused on my podcast, the After Chat, co-hosted by Josh Chernoff. I'm accused by Josh of always being politically correct. And he's been told by the fans to rake me over the coals and get the real Bill Apter out there, the bad guy Bill Apter, the Hollywood Bill Apter, the wonderful Willie Bill Apter out there. But I really can't say that there was ever anyone for a long or extended period of time, other than maybe a week or two, that would have that MO. Okay, so, it was a promoter in Texas. It was a woman promoter in Texas. I had worked with Terry Funk to come down and do some photograph some shows down there. And he was in Amarillo going to wrestle against Ivan Putski. Place was packed, small arena. I get by the ring. The woman promoter comes out, and I don't even remember her name. She says, you can't shoot at ringside. You can't shoot pictures at all. This is my promotion. I said, you got to be kidding. She said, no, you're not allowed to take pictures. I said, I was flown down from New York to take pictures here. I don't care. Ivan Putski and Terry Funk told that woman that if I'm not allowed to shoot pictures, she doesn't get their match. She qualified as an asshole.
Wow. A tuchus. Okay?
A tuchus. Yes.
Now, it took us a long time to figure out that story, but that's the best I
can
do. I
got an answer out of you.
You did. You
there
did.
You go. So, you well, did. Bill, on behalf
now,
of
now, wait a minute. Wait. That's the worst segue. I always tell people, there you go is always a horrible segue. You could say something to someone like, hey, how was your dinner? Hey, my dinner was great. Anthony's pizza was great. There you go. Both my kids despise me for doing this. If you count the there you goes that you hear every day, you can count up to 40 of them when you're conversing with people.
Well,
try
there you
it. Go. That's 41. There you go.
Bill, we really appreciate your time and congratulations again on your induction into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. Well deserved. Barry, will you join me in a Breaking Kayfabe round of applause for our man Bill?
A round of applause.
And by the way, if I can plug this, of course, my podcast drops. It's aired on the Pod Waves, and it comes out at midnight every Friday morning. We've had some notable names on, like Hulk Hogan, Hollywood Hogan, Sting, Rey Mysterio, Taz, Jim Cornette. Jim Cornette's the only guy who didn't like my book. Do you know why?
Why?
He said, Bill Apter doesn't bury anybody in that book. What the hell good is it? But right now, we have done without guests for 4 weeks, and the numbers are really good. Josh and I, Josh is young school, I'm older school, and we butt heads on a lot of stuff. I also, every show, I have one of my classic audio interviews. This week, I've got Fred Blassie and Spiros Arion talking about Bruno Sammartino and Pedro Morales. Also, my book, Is Wrestling Fixed? I Didn't Know It Was Broken, is still available. I'm still doing videos for onewrestlingvideo.com and still the editor for onewrestling.com. And I'm hosting conventions everywhere. And you can follow me at Apter One Wrestling. There's no N in Apter, like Dusty Rhodes thought. People, fans thought I was Willie Apner. It's APTER One Wrestling at on Twitter. So please follow me on Twitter. And this has been great. I've enjoyed it. I would like to do it again.
Yeah, we would love to have you back, Bill, because as we're sitting here talking, I'm thinking about 15 more questions.
Yeah, let's do it again. So I've got to end this with my catchphrase.
Lay it on us.
I'll see you at the matches.
And we'll see you at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdern and Barry.
There you go.
And we want to thank Bill for spending some time with us. Barry, that was a lot of fun. That's what happens when you run into a guy at a 7-Eleven, Barry.
Yeah, and I as we were chatting with Bill, I pulled up the photo and I found the photo of my son with Bill Apter in the belt. So when this drops in a day or so, I will post that. Not that anybody wants to see my son and Bill Apter, but I do. So I'm going to post the photo. But yeah, what a friendly guy. And what a guy. Look, you can debate whether he deserves to belong in a Hall of Fame. And realize, too, this is a Hall of Fame that is put out by a guy who does a wrestling newsletter. He has certainly reached out. Jeff, you're on the voting board, if I'm correct. He has reached out to historians, people that have been fans for 30 or 40 years. But at the end of the day, never let it be lost that this is essentially an electronic Hall of Fame. This is no brick-and-mortar building, and Hall of Fames, like everything else, really are going to be people's opinions. So Bill Apter, 50-plus year career in professional wrestling, he's seen it all. Debate all you want. He's in.
And he has some great stories from Bill, too. So we appreciate him taking some time. And Barry, he talked about after we were done coming back and joining us again for more discussions, and I would certainly love to do that. So as we're getting ready to wrap up here, folks, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Barry and I recently spent some time out of town. I had a chance to go up to Jacksonville to see my parents, and I went up to Atlanta to spend some time with my daughter and son. I brought the wife along, which I thought was really nice of me. And, so we went to a couple different restaurants in that area. Barry, I know you went to the City So Nice. They named it twice, New York, New York. You had a chance to visit some restaurants up there. Why don't you tell us about the places you went to in New York City?
Yeah, absolutely, too. So we had friends that came in from Orlando, and generally we go down to Florida. We always go to the West Coast, but we spend a couple of days in Orlando. We do all the theme parks. The couple, they have two kids that are roughly the same age as my kids, and they both work for Universal Studios. So it is great because we do get to do all the theme parks, but they've only been up here twice, and you really can't blame them. Why leave beautiful Florida and come up to Pennsylvania? You know, I was the psycho that did it. So they came up and it was like, all right, how much can we cram in the couple of days that they're going to be here? And we did. So we went up to New York City, and as with anything I do, it's always built around food. What do you want to see today? Well, you know, the little kids are like, yeah, I want to go see the Empire State Building. I'm like, I have three restaurants I want to go to. So we did. We did a lot of eating. I ate and did not stop eating. And I still haven't stopped eating, which is great. But we did get to try some new stuff. We tried some old stuff. And I got to say, it was a very successful trip for my stomach. Get in my belly. So it was good stuff. So one thing that, and again, I've been out of New York City for several years now. So one of the new things is something called Urban Space. An urban space is essentially similar to the Reading Terminal Marketplace. You've got food courts, but it's not your Chick-fil-A and McDonald's and Sparrow Pizza. This is all high-end shit. It's either exotic, the culinary delights, or, you know, it's like I got a pizza from this place called Roberta's, which based off the photo got mixed results, but it's, you know, that pizza was $20. So it isn't like you go get a slice from Sbarro for $250. You know, you're actually plopping down money. My son got empanadas. My daughter got these steamed pork buns from a Chinese place. So it was very cool because these urban spaces are all over the city now. There's at least three. We saw two, and then we heard that there was a third, but there may even be more. So it's a great concept, and I think Europe has been doing this for years. I know that when New York, there's a place up in the 80s, and they tried to copy what was taking place in Europe, and it's basically you go over there, and I want to say it was France, I think, is where I heard about this. And there's these buildings with all these different food stalls just making incredible food. And these aren't like big chains or anything like that. So that was great. I did get the pizza for dinner. And I looked online, and I think it was CNN.com is where I pulled it up. And it said, this is one of the best pizzas in New York. And that was Roberta's, and that's why I went. And it was. It was $20. It was a pizza with pepperoni, different types of cheeses, but it was fantastic. And it had the char in the crust, similar to, say, Anthony's. And as I found, that's extremely polarizing because every time I post a photo of an Anthony's pizza or this one, people are like, it looks like it's burned. And it's like, you know, yeah, Domino's never burns our pizza like that. I get it. But, you know, Anthony's is going to have the char. Roberta's has got the char. And, Jeff, quite frankly, I live for the fucking char at this point. So I really enjoyed that. For lunch that day, we were at a place called the Chelsea Market. And Chelsea Market is very similar to Reading Terminal Marketplace. But I got Japanese-inspired tacos. And I had it was a beef. I think it was a curried beef. And then I had a Chipotle and cilantro shrimp taco. And both were absolutely fantastic. I was actually a huge fan of the shrimp taco. I liked both though. My son, and this is where I love my son to death. My son walks in and he looks around and he goes, I'm going to get something I can never get at home. And he walks over to the Jamaican stall and he gets curried goat and oxtail stew. And that takes guts, first off. And he sits down, and God bless him, he eats every fucking bite on his plate of whatever was available. And when he was done, he goes, that was amazing. Could I get another plateful? So I have a lot of respect for that. So all in all, a very successful food-eating tour of New York, Jeff. Am I alone? I mean, do you do this as well? Do you, when you plan a vacation, and I realize, look, you're going to see your parents who live in Jacksonville, you're in Fort Lauderdale, your daughter's in a suburb of Atlanta. So a lot of your vacations are based around family, which really is probably the way a vacation should be based around. But am I alone in that when I'm going somewhere on vacation, whether it's business or pleasure, I'm doing the research to see where I'm meeting beforehand. Is that wrong? Am I alone in this, or do you do this as well?
No, I do that sometimes too. I mean, you know, there's no question. You know, when we went up to see my parents in Jacksonville, there was a pub that we went to, and I'm sitting there kicking myself in the head now. I think it's called the Three Sisters, Four Sisters, Five Sisters, something like that. It's an Irish pub, and the sisters are all from the Emerald Isle, and we really enjoyed ourselves there. And then, of course, my family, we go up to Atlanta, and let me just say that while we were up there, we had a chance to go to a place called the Ponce City Market. And the Ponce City Market, I was telling Barry earlier today, is very similar to a miniaturized Reading Terminal in Philadelphia, in that it's a two-story mall, and the mall has shops. It's kind of a little bit high-endy shops on the second floor. But on the first floor, there's about 15 different restaurants. And there's no chain restaurants, which I'm always a big fan of. And so my wife and I were walking around. My wife is a very picky eater, as I've discussed with Barry before. So we didn't see anything wrong. But what we did see is we're walking. There's like a little kind of a corner. You go there and you go behind. And there's like a juice place, you know, where you can get not a Jamba Juice, but something like that. And then we see there's a a little donut place. I was thinking of you, Barry. And I think it's called like the Three Sisters. So these restaurants named after sisters. But next to it, Barry, and you told me that you've seen one of these in New York, too. There is a place that sells nothing but cookie dough. Now, you get this cookie dough, and they get them in little small containers, like, you know, when you go into the grocery store and you need to buy ice cream for 32 people, and you get them in a bag, and they get these little small containers that basically have about 3 or 4 spoonfuls, and that's what you get. So you don't get yourself completely sick of the cookie dough, but it's just enough for you to go, holy shit, this is really good stuff. I got to be honest with you. So, Barry, you told me that you've seen one of those places in New York.
We saw it twice. So the place where I got Roberta's Pizza, which is one of these urban space places, there was actually right when you walk in the door, it was right there, and they were selling, I want to say it was like 6 different types of cookie dough, and they'll mix and match and you get it. And 2 or 3 people in our group, we were a group of 8, actually got it. I took one bite, and that was probably enough for me. I wasn't in love with it, but other people were saying it was the greatest thing they'd ever had.
Yeah. So, and then the last place we went to in Atlanta, this is a place that I'd wanted to go to for a while. It's on, I believe, the DeKalb Parkway in Atlanta. It is called Fox Brothers. And it is a barbecue joint that has been written up. I think Guy Fieri on his show had been there before. And I got to tell you, Barry, this place might have been one of the 2 or 3 best barbecue joints I've ever been to in my life.
Wow.
I mean, it was crazy good. Matter of fact, my wife and I are cooking chicken on the grill tonight. We bought their rub, and we're putting the rub on the chicken tonight before we put it on the grill. But great baked beans. Fries were good. Then we get to dessert. My wife and I decided to share a cup of the old Nana pudding. And what they did that was interesting was they had the banana pudding, of course. You had the vanilla wafers in there. But then they took vanilla wafers. They crushed them all up and sprinkled vanilla wafer all over the top. Oh, my God, Barry. I can feel my blood sugar going up just talking about it. Wow, that was unbelievable. So then we come back home, and the first night we got back, we got back kind of late, so we're looking for just something quick to eat. So, Barry, I had a chance, and you and I talked about this, another polarizing place, because I posted it on my personal page, and I must have got about 20 responses, and I think it was 10 to 10 people that loved it or people that hated it. And that is a place, Barry, and I'm going to let you offer your opinion, called Shake Shack. It's a BurgerFi kind of place. Barry, what are your thoughts on Shake Shack?
It's overrated. I think I've eaten there 5 or 10 times. I got to be honest, I feel like I'm missing out, because some people, they worship Shake Shack. It's like a cult. It's like In-N-Out Burger. And I feel like, okay, I'm missing out, and I go. The burgers are, in my opinion, I don't see what the deal is with the burger. There's nothing there for me. The fries are good. And what I really think, the shakes are even better, and they do something called a concrete. And I think the concrete is great. I did get a shake there years ago, and it was a toasted marshmallow shake, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I just think the burgers are a little bit weak.
Yeah, I will agree. The burger itself was nothing special. I mean, I enjoyed it, but it wasn't like, oh, my God, this is the greatest burger I've ever had. But you mentioned it, the French fries, I thought were absolutely incredible for a place that's kind of a not quite a sit down. I mean, there are tables in there, but it's like a step up of like a fast food joint. And for them to have French fries that good, I mean, golden cut, just baked or cooked exactly right, fried exactly right, whatever. And when I was sitting there eating, I looked at my wife. I said, boy, these French fries are pretty damn good. And I'm sitting there, and I'm wanting to reach into her little basket of fries, because I said, man, I feel like I want to go back and just get another friggin' basket full of fries. The fries were that good. So, Barry, as we're wrapping up, I know you wanted to mention one more time our friend Ian Douglas and his book about Bugsy McGraw called Brute Power.
Brute Power, the autobiography of Bugsy McGraw, and that's with 2 G's for Bugsy. Jeff, I got to say, I don't know if you've seen the latest total, but I'm super proud. And I got a message from Bugsy's co-author, Ian Douglas, who is listening right now. And he said, hey, he said, if you're recording today, and I had mentioned that we were going to be recording today. So if you're recording today, Please mention that we're only 29 pre-orders away from being fully funded. And I guess 29 being the book. You know, you could certainly go high end for the dinner or whatever it is. But I looked at the total just before we came on air, Jeff. We are, and when I say we, I include us because, hey, why not, right? We are $1,004 away from hitting that $3,500 total, which will get the book published. So the grand total right now, $2,496. I don't know this to be fact, but I kind of do in some ways. The majority of the sales for this book have come from either our group or the CWF group, which really, there's a lot of crossover right there between the members. That's really, really impressive in my eyes that people have coughed up, and it's people that you and I know, you know, they've all come forth. People have coughed up $2,500 to pre-order this book so it can get published. A, it shows the power of advertising on this podcast, that if you're even considering advertising on this podcast, you can ask Ian Totten, who had great results, and the proof is in the pudding, the banana pudding, Jeff, for Bugsy, Brute Power, the autobiography of Bugsy McGraw. We are there. We are $1,000 away from getting this book published. So if you're thinking of buying it, please do. This is the time to do it. Again, this keeps the podcast going. It gets history like this. And Professor Ouch made a great comment in our group the other day, and I believe he actually bought the scrapbooks. And what he said was, you know, I'm doing this because I want to preserve history. And the truth is, if this book doesn't get published, a lot of these stories are gone, Jeff. And it was, again, I'll reference this. This was you that said this to me, albeit in print, some 25 or 30 years ago. It's like fried green tomatoes where they sit there and they tell these stories. These stories have to be passed down generation to generation. You know, if this book doesn't go to print, a lot of these stories are going to be lost. So it's really important. So again, we encourage you. You can look at our Facebook group. You will see the link, Brute Power, the autobiography of Bugsy McGraw, $1,000 away from getting this thing published. If everybody listening goes in and even pledges 10 bucks, this book is going to be published.
So I know Barry will join me in a special Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Round of applause to all you good folks that have taken the time and put the dollar where your mouth is. And we do appreciate it. It's a great, great book. I can't stress that enough. I really did enjoy reading that book. And like you said, it's why it's so important for the history of the wrestling business to be told. And some of these stories that Bugsy told about guys like Joe LeDuc, Lonnie Mayne, stories of working for, you know, Jim Barnett down in Australia. These stories would have all been lost in time. And fortunately for us, Bugsy and Ian Douglas sat down and put pen to paper and got these stories in a book that I highly recommend and Barry highly recommends. And Barry, I think that's about it, my friend. Are we about ready to wrap up and start this new year off?
Oh, I think I got to go take a nap. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you've been hitting the bottle, much like apparently I did with the Lainey Kazan reference. But by the way, I checked. Absolutely no relation. I was like, man, if I could pull this out and go, aha, I thought it'd be great. But I can't. I would encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. I said industry last week. I didn't mean to say industry. We want to give a special shout out to our man, Sweet Lou Kippelman, working the production studios today. We certainly appreciate it. Sweet Lou, maybe we'll have you on again next week. We do appreciate your time, folks. And everybody, have a happy new year.